Here's a review by Anna Kisselgoff, the chief dance critic for the New York Times, writing in October of 1987. Fantastic! The Woodstock of the 80s? Grand Central Dances, a mammoth multimedia dance event staged in the nooks and crannies of Grand Central Terminal, on the vast expanse of its main concourse, within the walkways of its huge tiered windows, and even in the air, just a few feet below the station's cavernous ceiling. That will certainly remain a night to remember. Thousands of onlookers, mainly young, turned up Friday night on the street-level concourse of the station and its surrounding balconies to view a range of performers, from Merce Cunningham to Philippe Petit. The crowd went wild at the climax. The whole thing was a grand idea with a grand design, a very New York event that mobilized the resources of experimental artists and benevolent sponsors to create an unusual piece of theater in a very usual, if special, space. There were some problems. The fantasy that commuters hurrying home, the event began at 8 p.m. and ended at 10:20, would merely pause to look at the dancers and then go on, ran up against the reality of crowd control. Many of the spectators, packed in rows, had obviously come for the event. Those who did try to make a train plowed undaunted through the huge mass of onlookers. It was a jolt to realize that the clerks were still on duty in the information booth. At 9 p.m., Steve Koplowitz's Fenestrations got off to a spectacular start as 36 dancers in trios appeared at different times in the four-story windows facing Vanderbilt Avenue. The windows were illuminated at different times, and the choreographer moved the dancers into clever patterns that were both repetitive and continuous. A group on one level seemed suddenly to scurry across on the level below. In fact, another group had taken up the relay. The effect was witty and highly pictorial, suggesting stained glass windows. Produced by Elise Bernhardt and her Dancing in the Streets organization, the event was presented in cooperation with the Metro North Commuter Railroad and the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. A review by Anna Kisselgoff, and she was then chief dance critic for the New York Times, and she was writing in October of 1987 about Grand Central Dances, which included a work titled Fenestrations, created for the occasion by artist Stephen Koplowitz. That wasn't the only glowing review Fenestrations received. Other critics noted that the piece beautifully married human movement with structural form. According to a review in the New Art Examiner, the performance generated incisive patterns of order and chaos. By placing dancers directly within the building's glass frame, they effectively became angels of the architecture. The choreography mirrored the very essence of a major transit hub. Travel, continuous movement, and the bittersweet nature of missed connections. And, in a review published by the Philadelphia Inquirer, critics highlighted how the piece used lighting and geometry to mimic urban life. The dancers moved in wave-like effects that flowed from floor to floor, creating a literal moving picture framed by the window panes. The shifting colors and counterpoint movements captured the complex, multi-layered energy of New York City itself. We'll soon learn that Fenestrations was a milepost in Stephen Koplowitz's artistic journey. Contra Robert Frost, a site where two roads converged in his practice and informing each other in his work ever since. It seems Elise Bernhardt, founder and director of Dancing in the Streets, had seen an exhibition of Stephen's photographs the year before, and she intuited something about his creative dimensions, challenging him with this commission for Fenestrations. He says she knew more about my abilities than I did. And we'll be reminded all along about the importance for creative artists of having mentors, friends, and in this case, curators who see us and our work with fresh eyes. We're hearing a work titled Music on a Long Thin Wire by composer Alvin Lussier, Stephen's professor when he studied at Wesleyan. The piece provides an interesting ground base, a kind of metaphor, as we prepare to meet Stephen Koplowitz. Not only because Stephen has been taken with technology throughout his life, Lussier describes the source of the sound here. The wire is extended across a large room, clamped to tables at both ends. The ends of the wire are connected to the loudspeaker terminals of a power amplifier placed under one of the tables. A sine wave oscillator is connected to the amplifier. A magnet straddles the wire at one end. Wooden bridges are inserted under the wire at both ends, to which contact microphones are embedded, rooted to a stereo sound system. The microphones pick up the vibrations that the wire imparts to the bridges and are sent through the playback system. By varying the frequency and loudness of the oscillator, a rich variety of slides, frequency shifts, audible beats, and other sonic phenomena may be produced. Music on a long, thin wire might just body forth for us, symbolize, in a sense, a certain through line that runs through the body of Stephen's work, as varied as it is. Lussier's sound is not static. He describes its rich variety of slides, frequency shifts, audible beats, and other sonic phenomena. And yet its source, again, one long, thin wire. We'll recognize right away in our conversation that Stephen is very self-aware. In and around the COVID shutdown, he had a chance to re-examine his entire body of work, noticing in detail what's been important for him in his creative explorations over the years. But there's been a happenstance in his life since then that has been, in a way, revelatory. Heather Sienkiewicz, associate professor and director of the Sordoni Gallery at Wilkes University, has built an exhibition of Stephen's work they're calling Of Place and Passage, and it opened yesterday and will run through October 18th. If words like perception, reflection, and encounter are some of what Stephen explores in his work, his first encounter with this show at the Sordoni has helped him experience his own work freshly. He is actually bowled over with surprise. And we might suggest that Heather's become attuned to that metaphorical through line with all its harmonics, frequency shifts, and rich variety, leading her to create counterpoint and conversations between and among the pieces she's selected for the show. And she hopes that through image, motion, and our experience of the space, that the exhibition encourages us to look closely, move thoughtfully, and discover a certain choreography embedded within the everyday, reflecting Stephen and his creative vision in a fundamental and exemplary way. Artist Stephen Koplowitz and Sordoni Gallery Director Heather Sienkiewicz, curator of the show, paid a visit to the WVIA studios to introduce us to the work of this award-winning artist and how it is that Of Place and Passage has come about.
The fact that I have this show here is one of the most unexpected things that has ever happened in my career. Okay, really quick. I wrote a book that came out in 2022. It was published by Oxford Press on how to create site-specific performance. And, you know, I was very happy, very proud. And I have a friend who was my high school roommate. We went to Quaker School together, and we've been friends for the last 50-plus years now. Jeff Davidowitz. And Jeff has always been interested in what I do all these years. and a supporter. And when the book came out, I was desperate to get people interested in the book. So he said, oh, well, let me send an email and see if anyone at Wilkes University will be interested, because his mother was a trustee and he's a trustee. And he said, you know, let's see what, you know, see what happens. So he sent this email to Paul Riggs, mm-hmm. and I guess he included my website or something in it. And then Paul forwarded that email to a bunch of folks at Wilkes, and Heather was one of them. And then somebody got back to me and said, oh, they're not interested in your giving a book talk. The curator of the gallery wants to mount an exhibition of your work. And my first reaction was, oh, yeah, right. You know, like, that's never going to happen, or you got to be kidding me. And I think Jeff might have said, oh, no, I think. And so then little by little, I started Googling, and, you know, then Heather got involved in the conversation. And then, of course, I Googled Heather and looked at her website, and I watched videos of her work. And so things started to make a little more sense, because I realized her orientation towards art and the expansive way she would define it. Because honestly, she must have just looked at my website. And it's funny, because half of the work that's in the show was not even available to her. Mm-hmm. She was already interested. And then I met with her and brought her more work. And I can't tell you, I mean, this is one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my career. I'm not joking.
Heather, what did you see in that limited amount of work that you had access to?
Well, you know, I think one thing with Stephen throughout the time that we've been working together on this is that it's that performance is also a visual medium. And it's not always, and especially with Stephen's work, it's rarely on a stage. It's usually in a public space. And I thought that was incredibly interesting to activate a public space in that way. So I thought that it might be great to start to bring that into dialogue into our space. And knowing that at Wilkes University, we have a small dance program and we have our musical theater, BFA and such, our students are looking at dance in a more traditional way. And I'm always thinking about the gallery in ways of how can I connect with our programs that are already on campus and have them see the things that they are studying in a different way. So I thought Stephen was an excellent choice to bring to campus to look at. You don't have to stay tunnel visioned in that regard. So how can we widen the scope? So as we got to know each other and as we started working together, we actually went to a few exhibitions together, in particular the Alvin Ailey that was at the Whitney. And that was...
Which was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, talk about great timing, right?
Right, exactly.
Because we were looking at...
And then Ralph Lemon.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly.
I think we did that in one day.
We did.
That's right.
And such different shows too, like different ways of approaching dance and a more static medium. It was really, really good to do that because we got to know each other really well through all that. And mm-hmm. I think could temper sort of a vision for what the exhibition would become.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I actually hadn't thought of that mm-hmm. day that we spent together, which was really intense mm-hmm. because the work was intense and quite inspiring on many levels. You know, Alvin Ailey and Ralph, I knew Ralph for many, many years, over 40 years. We met when he was just starting out back in the 70s. And he's an incredible artist. But I have to say, she has put together my work in the context of a museum, of a gallery, in a way that I feel complements those two exhibitions in a way that I'm very proud, actually. And it was a really great way for us to start a dialogue, even though we'd already talked about my work, yeah. you know, to in a certain sense. But then it was like, how is it going to be presented? But, you know, she's done an incredible job. I mean, on Monday morning when I saw the show up pretty much, you know, 90% up, I started crying. Yeah, because I was just so overwhelmed with emotion to see all my work, all this work from different parts of my life and all these different ideas that I've been working with over time come together and all in dialogue, which she has created that dialogue. And she's made connections that I have seen or whatever, but to have it all in one place. And so there's an energy going on in that, in the exhibition. To me, that's, you know, sort of 2 + 2 does not equal 4. It's equaling 5, 6, 7, 8.
What was it then that gave you this sense, well, I can start and we can do this and this speaks to this? Was it actually both getting to know Stephen and, for example, taking in the Alvin Ailey show and the Ralph show?
It was all of that, yeah. Because before that, Stephen had come to campus and brought a ton of his, he has several books that he's put together, like of different portfolios of work, both of work that embodies movement, but also work that is more lens-based. Because what's important to the show is that there is lens-based or photography-based works, there's video works, and then there are documentation of works that were done on site. You know, so I thought it was really important to kind of pull together and string those things together to not necessarily look at him as an artist that does different things, but look at a practice that is interconnected. And that was really important to me to show, is to show how the practice is interconnected.
And you felt that when you saw the show on Monday, that she really understood that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew what was going to be in the show, obviously, because she had sent me all these documents.
Many spreadsheets.
And she said, you know, these are the works that I want. And so it wasn't like a surprise that, oh, I didn't know that was going to be in the show. I knew everything was going to be in the show. But the way she has placed things, the way everything is placed within the space and how you get to experience it from one room to the next. And, you know, honestly, I mean, I'll be very honest. At one point she said, well, we're going to do, we talked about having four spaces and four things. And then she was like, no, we're going to do three. And I was like privately going, oh, I want all this stuff in the show. And then I realized, you know what? She's been doing this. This is what she does. This is not what I do. Just go with it. I mean, there were a couple of things when I said, really, you really want to show that instead of this? But in the end, I realized I don't have the same perspective. You know, if I were to mount a show, it would not be as good as this show is, if you know what I mean by that. I would put too much in, and I would probably put work that is off, that is not adding anything to the conversation. There's a very clear through line. And that to me, you know, when I make my own work that is temporal, I try to be very disciplined about that. And she has that discipline and that experience. And she's an artist, too, that deals with time and deals with performance and deals with the body. So, yeah.
You've each already used the word the space of the gallery, but space is so fundamental to your work and what you do. So what is it like to have a space like the Sordoni Gallery to exhibit or put before us and have in dialogue works that concern space and our sensitivity or not to the spaces we inhabit as humans? You're creating a space for his work to do what it does when you're not on site in a mall.
Well, actually, I mean, the thing that I'm really happy about, because that space is a malleable space. I mean, it changes depending on what Heather is mounting. So it's almost like a neutral space. But what I'm very happy about is that someone can come through and not be overwhelmed, and at the same time be overwhelmed. Does that make sense? Be overwhelmed in a sense. What I'm very happy about is that it shows a certain level of variety, and it shows a certain level of discipline in terms of taking an idea to an extreme, so to speak. It allows the work to show its depth, and instead of having you know 25 things, you get to look at eight pieces of one type of work, and really it lets each piece breathe. See, there's breath. It was interesting when she was describing what she wanted. You know, she's talking about, well, I want to have a proper way to have projection work that's projected. Yeah. Because I have, you know, photographs that are framed on the wall like any other artist does, you know, in a show like that. And so being able to see both at the same time. And she's done a great job of lighting the work that's on the wall and allowing the projections to be vibrant and beautiful and coexist right next to each other.
I think scale was really important to me as well, you know, because there are works that are on television monitors. Obviously, there's work that is framed, the still work, and then the projections as well. We've suspended a screen, so it looks like it's floating there, and that's like kind of mid-range, you know. And I was thinking a lot about how I'm going to layer the space and how people are going to move through it. And at one point where we've suspended the screen where there's two monitors, and it's a work across three monitors. It's the same space, but moving at a different speed, essentially. But I thought that then layered in front of a piece that's in like a natural setting, the bridge piece, and looking at something completely different. And in the, say, just in the front, I mean, you have this enormous projection of Grand Central Station. So you are seeing the different varieties of spaces. And I think something that Steve is best known for is site-specific movement, site-specific choreography. So I really wanted those, like someone who knows Steve, they're like, awesome, great. I'm going to know this is Steve, but then you're going to be hit by the work that he's maybe not known as well for, the more photo-based work. And like I said before, you're seeing how it's not just something that he does sometimes, it's work that is informed by one and the other. And that was super, super important for me.
I mean, the thing about this show that for me is so emotional is that anyone who's known me or thinks they know my work, when they go see this show, they'll recognize some things, but they'll see a completely different side of me, which has been, in a way, I mean, I tell people, yeah, I have a secret life as a visual artist, you know, or a secret life as a whatever. And that's sort of true and not true, because in my own work, I've incorporated media and visual aspects in it repeatedly since, well, actually the first one where I actually used media in a big site work was in 1998. I used projection in a work I did for the British Library for the Dance Umbrella Festival, and projected images in between the balconies of the library, the new library at St. Pancras. And I used props, visual props, which I never did before. I used to have a rule that I would keep the space pristine. Of course, I've evolved since then, and I did one piece with newspapers on the ground. I mean, I incorporated visual aspects to it, and I've been doing that more and more and more in my work, to the point now where I'm always thinking visually as a visual artist at the same time that I'm staging my temporal work. And I've come to realize, you know, it was interesting during the pandemic. I finished my book during the pandemic, and at the same time that I was doing that, I was digitizing my entire archive of the last 40 years, because I was moving from LA back to New York and had negotiated with the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts to take my archives. And so I'm not finished working as an artist, and I wanted access to my own work, despite that I was handing it over to them. So I digitized everything. And I really came to realize that, yes, I'm interested in theater and dance and narrative and all these things, or whatever, be abstract or literal, whatever. But in the end, it has to look good. In the end, the visual aspect of everything I do is very, very important. And in some ways, it's, you know, I can't let go of that. And even when I made Grand Central, see, this is the thing. I mean, and this is what's ironic. When I was 30 years old, I had a visual art show, a one-person show at a gallery that was connected to Dance Theater Workshop, which is now New York Live Arts. Not all the work that was in that show, but the three aspects of that show are in this show. And that work, those photographs I made in photo booths, were seen by a friend who was a producer who was producing large-scale site-specific work. And when she saw that work, and when a very famous choreographer named Lucinda Childs declined to put dancers in the windows of Grand Central because she didn't think it was going to be safe or whatever, she said, I'd like my dancers to be on the stage with Merce Cunningham. Elise Bernhardt, the producer, was actually surprised by the response. And then all of a sudden, you know, wasn't sure what to do. And then she remembered that she saw my photographs, and she made the connection that, oh, those photographs remind me of the windows. I bet Steve could probably figure out what to do in the windows of Grand Central. And I've never really made a site-specific work before. And so that's what started my career. And so ironically, my visual art work started my career as a site-specific artist.
And the pieces from your visual art exhibition, that first one, you saw that they should be in this show.
Right, because in a sense, it's the genesis. That's the thing. It's the genesis of my entire career as a site artist. Now, I have a career as a concert dance artist or as a proscenium artist. And there, my work is still very visual. And I actually incorporated my visual sensibility into that. But it's also very narrative and very verbal and text. All my work for the stage was text and movement, was dance theater. But it always had to look good. There was always a visual aspect to that. But then words were also a very big focus.
Let me take you back to little Stephen then. How was that visual sense that you don't want to let go of? How was that developed when you were a young lad?
Well, when I was in high school, I was interested in photography, and I started taking photographs. My father was in government. He was in the CIA, actually, and I grew up, part of my life, I grew up in France, and I started photography, I think, in ninth grade and took a lot of photographs, just was taken by it, and I continued to do that in 10th grade, but I stopped taking photographs or working as a photographer because I didn't have the patience to work in a dark room and figure out, you know, taking the film out of the camera and putting it in chemicals and all that stuff. But I was really taken by it. And then when I got to college and I was at Wesleyan, I was in a place where all the arts, Wesleyan has the Center for the Arts, where they had all the arts all in one place. Music, and I was a music major, you know, music, visual art, dance, and theater. And in a sense, I don't know where I got this, but I was always interested in technology to a certain extent, and to media, it always fascinated me, because people like John Cage and Merce Cunningham and Andy Warhol and Meredith Monk and Laurie Anderson, these are all people that fascinated me. And so my thesis as a senior in college was music and the visual media arts. And I wrote film scores that were very conventional narrative, almost mini Hollywood movies. And all those directors that I wrote music for went on to having big commercial careers. And then I created an interactive dance work that was involved video and live sound and dance. And then I made music, not on audio tape, but on videotape. And so part of my thesis was a concert of what I called music/video. A year before MTV came out with music videos. But it was all very avant-garde, in a sense, you know, very new music, because I was studying, you know, my mentor was the composer Alvin Lucier. And so I was, in a sense, making music on video. And so that just became part of my DNA. And so, you know, I carried that with me into everything I did after that. And that piece I did at Wesleyan, because it took place in a gymnasium, was my first realization that you could make things outside of the theater. I couldn't do my concept that I had, because it was the idea that there was four lights that were focused on four different parts of the space, and each light had a video camera focused on the light, and half the audience saw the piece through the eyes of four video monitors live, and then half the audience saw it live looking at it on bleachers, and an intermission they trade places. So the piece was all about perception, which is in a sense what has been my lifelong interests, dealing with how we perceive the world, how we perceive the body, and how we perceive our environment, and just how perception affects our meaning, and how perception affects how we feel, and, you know, and what art is.
Award-winning artist Stephen Koplowitz and Sardoni Gallery director Heather Sienkiewicz, associate professor at Wilkes University and curator of the show titled Of Place and Passage, Actions and Images by Stephen Koplowitz. It opened yesterday, September 1st, and will run through October 18th of this year. And you'll have a chance to meet and speak with Stephen Koplowitz at an Art in Context lecture, and that's Thursday, September 17th. At 5 p.m. at the Sardoni Gallery. A reception will follow. And to find the gallery, it's located at 141 South Main Street in Wilkes-Barre. And to find them online, wilkes.edu/Sardoni Art Gallery. And Sardoni is spelled S-O-R-D-O-N-I. wilkes.edu/Sardoni Art Gallery. Of Place and Passage, Actions and Images by Stephen Koplowitz, running now through October 18th at the Sardoni Art Gallery, 141 South Main Street, on the campus of Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. This is the first of a two-part conversation with Stephen and Heather.